This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. They called it a modern underground railroad. It was a network of churches and activist groups across the United States that ferried Latin American refugees to safety in the 1980s. They were running away from political violence in Central American countries whose regimes were supported by the U.S. government. Restrictive immigration policies made it hard for those refugees to find asylum, and the people who helped them were breaking the law. A Roman Catholic nun was among the leaders of the sanctuary movement. Sister Darlene Nagorski had always felt a call to service, a call rooted in her religious faith. Her work in rural Mississippi and then Guatemala led her to see that she might have to break a few local laws to obey a higher authority. Eventually, she was arrested and convicted, along with seven others, on immigration charges. She was sentenced to 5 years probation. Darlene Nagorski has since left the convent and now lives in Chapel Hill, and she's my guest this hour. Darlene Nagorski, welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I certainly want to talk about your work in the sanctuary movement, but first I want to find out how you got there. You grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a Catholic household?
Yes, a very strong Catholic household and kind of immigrant backgrounds, second generation, German, Polish. That was typical of Milwaukee. And parents who got married during the Depression and couldn't get further education but really valued it. So it was Catholic grade school, Catholic high school, Catholic college, because that was seen as a great education.
And it certainly was at that time a kind of a private school education in many ways.
Yes.
Were you devout at the time yourself?
Yes, I was. And looking back, you can look differently at things than at the time growing up in the 1950s. But somehow I just didn't see myself going the usual route. And in high school, I remember reading every missionary book there was and pictured myself somewhere on a horse in Peru and felt very called by the strong social justice mission that was part of the Catholic Church that I grew up with.
A social justice mission or a mission? I mean, at that time, and I'm thinking of those mission magazines that were calling to me as well. So I'm visualizing those magazines.
Yes, the Marinol magazines.
The Marinol magazines. There were a lot of bloated bellies, a lot of children who needed help, and there was poverty, and I can remember that. But social justice, not so much. In terms of political justice, in terms of changing economic and political systems, did you sense that at the time?
I certainly didn't have the political perspective that I gained through walking with people. Acompañamiento, a good word in Spanish, means walking with, seeing through their eyes, learning, which I think is the process that I used. But I also grew up in the 60s, and so you couldn't avoid the civil rights movements. Father Grappi going down the streets of Milwaukee, the Chicago riots, those kinds of things helped to inform, and I was part of a Christian student movement in college, and we went around to different campuses and got educated on different movements going on.
And you decided to become a nun?
Yes.
Tell us about the order, the Franciscans, is that right?
I was a member for 21 years of the School Sisters of St. Francis. They were headquartered in Milwaukee, although originally a German congregation. And their mission was strongly in terms of education, thus the name School Sisters, education and nursing. I also think that growing up in the 50s in a strong Catholic family, the opportunities and the images that I saw acceptable for women were more limiting than today. So my sister became the nurse. I became the teacher. And those were kind of acceptable roles if you went to college.
But you had very much on your mind as a nun, to be a nun who would be in service.
Yes.
And yes. You went to rural Mississippi. Was that your first?
No, my first was in Milwaukee, where I taught at a college campus school. And I had 25 5-year-olds in the morning and 18 4-year-olds in the afternoon, in the days where there were no teacher aides.
Yeah, so if you didn't have faith, really, you'd be out of that school in a day, right?
Yeah. But I mean, it was really a great opportunity for a great teaching experience. It was experimental, everything. But that yearning to go somewhere else, I felt I grew up with a pretty good family and opportunities. Yeah. And I guess somehow I felt that urgency that I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to share that. And so an opportunity came, congregation in Holly Springs, Mississippi, and they just finished my master's in early childhood education. They asked me to come and help start a daycare center on campus because so many of the high schoolers, there was an elementary and a high school, were dropping out to take care of their babies early.
What did you learn down there as a result of your work? How long were you there?
I was there about 5 years. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot about other cultures. I was in the Midwest, pretty white, and this was mostly African-American, very rural, poor. I'd ask for directions. Oh, you go down where this store is, and you saw women cooking cornbread on open fires, and saw it as, you know, missionary experience. I feel like it really prepared me for going to Guatemala later.
Well, Dan, tell us about that. You did get to Guatemala.
Yes, I from Mississippi. I went for a year in transition, and I worked as kind of a community organizer, social worker in a low-income housing project in Nebraska. And while there, I started studying Spanish, and there was a program in the congregation called Living Aware, which took you out of your normal environment, and you spent 2 months somewhere else. I had signed up to go to Peru. I didn't get my first choice. I got the second choice, Guatemala. So I went there for 2 months, and it was a very positive experience. And I was only back a couple of months, and I got a letter asking me to come in cuanto antes and work with them. And now I knew más pronto posible, as quickly as possible. So I had to look up that idiomatic expression, so I will never forget it. And it means similar, as soon as possible, because they were trying to establish a network of preschool education in many of the poor aldeas or little villages. Mm-hmm. And they were expecting some violence to possibly come in a couple of years. And so they thought this network or red of communication would be invaluable to keep in touch with the peasants.
Forgive me, but they were expecting violence in that area. The country was already embroiled in a civil war, was it not?
Just a little bit, and mostly on the western part of the country where the indigenous or the Indian populations were. There's about 27 different dialects in Guatemala, and so that's where a lot of it was taking place, and they didn't expect it to come over. And of course, El Salvador was, and Nicaragua had already been through its revolution.
And so this was what year now?
This was 1981.
So 1981, you get a call to come down pretty darn quick. You do, and this is to help set up this network, this education network, hopefully as a bulwark against violence. It doesn't work. You learned you were not there long when your pastor was murdered on his way to that village.
Yes. I needed to take a couple months to study Spanish seriously. I did that. We were just starting to get things rolled out. And suddenly and unexpectedly, we got the word. I still remember the knock on the fence to the property we had. Abra la puerta, abra la puerta, open the gate. They killed Father Tulio. People had come to tell us. And things escalated pretty quickly from there because we were told our names were on a list and we would need to leave. And many of the delegados de la palabra, lay leaders in the church, were also asked to leave, or suggested that their names were on a list.
And tell us, Ben, of course, violence had already, we know about the violence in El Salvador, Bishop Oscar Romero, four church women, Oscar Romero killed four church women in that country, mm-hmm. raped and murdered. So this was not an unfamiliar story in that part of the world by then.
No, and it's very difficult to say who did it or why did it come. I think the general consensus was that in that part of Guatemala, like some of the other regions on the western part, the church was getting a pretty strong hold. And I live through Pope John the 23rd when he opened the windows, so-called, in the Catholic Church, and things started to change. Growing up, I don't know about your experiences, Frank, but growing up, basically Catholics, as Catholics, we had the Bible interpreted to us, and compared to my Protestant friends who read it as a primary source. So with all the changes in the 60s, women, poor people started reading the Bible as primary source, and it took on a different meaning, and terms like liberation theology came in. It was no longer the message like, thank God you're poor and you will be rewarded in the next life, but rather, what can you do so that your family can become educated and so we can change 2% of the people owning 80% of the land? And that's what became a threat to the status quo.
And that scripture also became the root for something called the sanctuary movement, which you became a very important part of. We'll talk about that, your escape from Guatemala, and your entry into the sanctuary movement. That will happen when I continue my conversation this hour with former nun and activist Darlene Nagorski on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Darlene Nagorski is with me. She was convicted of crimes connected with her work in the sanctuary movement of the 1980s. She and others were helping Central American refugees flee from political violence in their home countries. Darlene was a Catholic nun at the time. She since left the convent and moved to Chapel Hill. Tell us about your escape from Guatemala. How did that go?
Well, it was in stages that various ones of our group of 16 or something like that left. I left with one group, and we went to Tegucigalpa, Honduras, where we had congregation, and we lived there, 14 women in one house and one bathroom. That was a challenge right there. We were waiting to get word about what was going to happen next, and eventually we got refuge in Chiapas, Mexico, in the seminary there. San Cristobal de las Casas was the city, and the bishop was Don Samuel Ruiz, and he knew firsthand about the violence that was happening from the Indian populations in Lake Atitlan and other areas like that. They were flowing across the border into Mexico. And so one of the things we did while we were waiting there was we started helping. So we took food, clothing. We also took testimony for various human rights groups. And the stories, unfortunately, one began to meld into the next. The army came. The army came and separated the men and the women. It raped the women, and it killed many of the men. They burned their crops so they couldn't go back, and they fled across the border and were living literally in camps, not like kind of UN camps either. They were just very basic. And
so you're there, and I know that you wanted to get back to Central America, but then your plan fell through.
Well, there was a plan that there were people who were in touch with folks in Guatemala, and there was a thought some of them had actually, of our congregation, had gone back to Guatemala City, and there was a thought that some of us would start working in the refugee camp in Honduras called El Tesoro, which is where many of these lay leaders of the church went to... had fled. Mm. So we had a plan. It was going to be a native Guatemalan nun, myself, and another nun still studying Spanish. I was going to teach the adults. Albertina was going to work with the mothers and families, teach them to crochet, how to tailor the donated clothing, etc. And I was with Albertina in Guatemala City when she spent $100, which was a lot of money, for yarn, etc., to take with her. And she left, and I was going to come in a few days. And she was kidnapped on her way there. because we had headquarters in the United States, I believe, we were able to get her released in 3 days. She was held by Guatemalan military authorities, and I remember the TV news in Guatemala saying that she was a guerrilla nun and she was transporting weapons to the guerrillas across the border.
This would be yarn.
Yes, this was yarn. Exactly.
Weapons of mass crocheting.
Yeah, she was not tortured physically, but she was a little bit psychologically. Go on.
Well, I'm wondering about you at this time. I mean, you've been through violence in Guatemala. You've seen your pastor murdered. Now this kidnapping had to be 3 difficult days. Are you afraid at this time? What's going through your mind?
I probably, at that point, probably didn't know enough to be as afraid as I should have been. But I certainly was a bit overwhelmed because I still didn't have a totally firm grasp on the language, let alone the politics of everything that was going on, but certainly didn't want to feel like I'm going to run home.
You did have to go home eventually, though.
Well, it was decided that probably I hadn't been feeling well, that probably I should go for a couple months of R&R and get things straightened out. Where's the best place to serve? And I did that, and visiting my parents, who were retired in Arizona, I ended up having some surgery and some recuperation time, and that's when I started educating myself about what was going on and read all the books I could about the Guatemalan history and the influence of the United States and the banana corporations in Guatemala, and started finding groups that were working with refugees who had fled.
And this was what would come to be known as the sanctuary movement.
Yes. As I was doing this, in one of the places was at Elzona Lutheran Church in Phoenix, where a Lutheran pastor had a Bible study group on Sunday evenings in Spanish. So I started going there and meeting people. And Pastor Oinas and I went out to some of the fields where people were picking grapefruits and oranges. We found a pregnant woman who needed medical attention. There were some growers who were so mean that they'd work the immigrants, and then when payday came, they'd call INS on them. And so we started responding to these needs, and this Mary Knoll friend that I knew from Guatemala came to Phoenix. She stayed with me. She told me about the sanctuary movement, which the Chicago Religious Task Force on Central America was one of the groups really helping to promote this nationally. And Frontline did a story with her transporting this family to a convent in Kansas. And I was part of it, but I didn't want to go on the TV under the TV camera because I thought I was still going back. But as I discerned further and started getting involved with the Tucson Connection, Southside Presbyterian, which was the first church to declare sanctuary, I decided this was where I could best help, was in my own country, because I maybe naively thought if people really understood what was happening in this country with our money and what it was doing to these people, they would stop it. They wouldn't want it to happen.
Well, and just talk a little bit more about that. Go from this time when you're looking at these magazines, missionary magazines, and you see people suffering, they're poor, and you think, I could help them by just relieving some of that. And then you read and you begin to understand, oh, wait, this stuff doesn't just happen. People actually create whole systems. And now you realize, with the help of your own government, that have created this poverty, that have created this suffering, and now you're going to do something about it.
Yes, and the refugees proved to be the best truth tellers or the best converters, because they were human beings. It wasn't a story out there. It's not like dropping a bomb on somebody and you don't know the effects of what you're doing when you're doing that. And you've heard the stories from Vietnam and the names that they would call as their, because they weren't people. They weren't real. What the sanctuary movement tried to do is, not only were the border areas getting all backed up with people fleeing, and we had actually tried the legal route, getting political asylum. I testified at several cases before Judge Nail in Phoenix about the general conditions in Guatemala and El Salvador. I think out of 90 cases, only one got political asylum.
So we should stop right there and talk about why this was so difficult to give political and status, asylum status, to these people fleeing civil war. It wasn't happening during the 1980s. Why not?
It wasn't happening because it was the State Department who was dictating who got political asylum. And in the course of doing this, I learned that there was a 1985 Refugee Act that said that we should stop doing asylum based on our political perspective. So if you're a Chinese tennis star, it's a communist country. If you come from Cuba, we could automatically give you asylum. But rather, we should individually look at each case. And so that's what was happening. It was the State Department dictating, because our foreign policy under Ronald Reagan was sending millions of dollars a day to countries like El Salvador, Guatemala, to fight the communist, the fear of a rebellion. And it was our own School of the Americas that was teaching some of these countries' military leaders how to do torture with their own people. And I think initially, like when the frontline story was done on the family going to Kansas, INS was contacted. That's what immigration was called at the time. They said, we're not interested in pursuing this. It's just a group of church people helping. Well, at some point, we're convinced an order came from Washington to shut this movement down. And if they indicted what they saw as some of the leaders, that would end it, because it was becoming a threat. Because you had here this Middle America, Kansas, or Western Priory in Vermont, or this church in Illinois, wherever, all of a sudden these people are sitting across the table from this professor at the University of San Salvador, and, well, what, you have a family? Well, why did you leave your family, and why are they there? And soon they were hearing the story, and these same people were protesting at their local government offices against our foreign policy. And I think the Reagan administration decided they didn't want another Vietnam protest.
Because their policy was you could only seek asylum if you were fleeing communism. And also there is a law that prohibits American aid to go to countries where there is this kind of conflict going on. So if there's a political conflict, you can't be helping one of the sides in this. And so to acknowledge that there was political conflict from which you might be seeking asylum would mean to risk that aid. And so the Reagan administration, which used extra legal means to get around those laws anyway, decided that people coming from those countries weren't seeking asylum. How did the sanctuary movement work? How it's a network of churches and activists, and how does it work?
It really didn't have a lot of leadership. It really was a kind of community outreach thing, and we invoked the ancient tradition of sanctuary that had last been used during the Vietnam War to, you know, that it was a safe haven, somewhere where authorities would not come and arrest people, conscientious objectors in the 70s. And then secondly, to creatively thought of the term the New Underground Railroad, taking it from the civil rights days. And what it was is, and the government had labeled me the travel agent in their opening statement to the jury, that I was the travel agent, the only woman in the senior group. So I was labeled the travel agent, that I organized the travel. So if a family was coming from Tucson to Phoenix, then from Phoenix some volunteers would drive a Flagstaff, then somebody would drive from Flagstaff to Albuquerque. That was the Underground Railroad. It was very loose. It was all volunteers. I never consciously thought, I'm going to be arrested. I mean, I knew there was talk that some of the things we were doing were illegal. There were so many people I respected, and this just couldn't be right. what we were doing.
But as you say, at first they didn't take the movement seriously at all. It was a public movement. I mean, people were in churches,
yes,
priests and ministers and rabbis all talking about this
thing. We had TV cameras, newspapers there, yes.
And then, as you say, they clamped down. They call it, interestingly enough, you named it New Underground Railroad, and apparently they took you up on it. They called the investigation into your movement Operation Sojourner.
Yes.
As if to acknowledge that this great thing in American history is something we have to crack down on in the administration. They do. You're arrested. And you say, interestingly enough, if I'm guilty of anything, I'm guilty of the gospel. Well, you're quoted as saying that. Maybe
yes,
you never
yes,
did.
Yes. No, I probably sounds like something I would have said.
So if you're not expecting to be arrested, but you were, what was going through your mind at the time?
I was actually in Michigan at the time on a retreat for returning missionaries. And I came in from a walk, and several people accosted me to tell me this was happening. And so a decision, what did I need to do? And I went with a group to Detroit, where a family that I had helped was in sanctuary at St. Rita's Catholic Church in Detroit, and we did a press conference talking about it. So it was publicly I was there. I was obviously very upset and didn't know, you know, there is no path for this.
Yeah.
You know, you become a nun, it's sort of like this is what your life is going to be. But my life was never that way. It's sort of like you make the road as you go. Mm-hmm. And that's what was happening. And when I got back to Phoenix, there was a date set for our indictment. And it was in Phoenix, and we decided there was organized where it was going to be a prayer service at the cathedral in downtown Phoenix, and we would walk the 6 or 8 blocks to the courthouse. 950 people walked with us with signs saying, if they are guilty, so am I.
Well, talk about that trial and the effect of that trial along those lines, because it did become international news, and it seems to me a real opportunity to raise the cause of Latin American refugees and bring it to public attention. Do you think it had that effect?
Oh, definitely. I think while, you know, the government, by their very narrowly defined case, won in that court, we won in the court of public opinion. For example, I can't remember what paper had an editorial cartoon the day we were convicted with the Statue of Liberty crying, bring me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. It was a very different environment regarding refugees and immigrants in the 1980s than today.
Well, and you talked about that law in 1985 that
right,
essentially overturned or challenged State Department policy. So all of this is in play as this movement and this political crisis is coming to a head. In 1987, so we should say you were convicted. You could have gone to jail for 25 years. You were sentenced to 5 years probation. What did you make of the sentence?
I think there was pretty much a feeling that while Judge Carroll didn't really like any of us, he also didn't want to make us martyrs and bring more support to the cause, because he very much tried to control his courtroom, and it was very difficult because there was so much attention, so much press. I mean, one day there were Vietnam vets who came and threw blood across the wall in his courtroom saying, the blood of the people of Central America is in your hands, and these kinds of things. We had no knowledge of that, but they very much upset him and all the attention, and he tried to keep it controlled. But he also knew if we were sent to jail or prison that he would just give further foment to the movement.
What about the movement itself, the sanctuary movement? Did the arrests and convictions have a chilling effect on that? Did it become harder to do business? Did fewer people want to participate or more? What effect did it have?
I think it continued very much, and it's still continuing today, but obviously not in the same way because the situations have changed in Central America. But there are still people that are very much involved in border efforts, and the sanctuary movement certainly helped to take the cover away, to make more transparent what the Reagan administration was trying to do regarding Central America. And there was a subsequent case in the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco in which the real issues that should have been heard in our trial but were disallowed were heard. And that case won. And that's why there's a large number of Salvadorans and Guatemalans to this day who have this temporary protective status and every year have to go pay money again to get another year because they've never settled this issue. But all those cases heard during that period of time had to be retried and are in this status because it was shown that they were not following our own laws and were taking the State Department's word about who's a refugee or not.
Well, we'll find out what happened when you made the cover of Ms. Magazine a couple of years later as my conversation with Darlene Nagorski, a former Catholic nun and leader of the Sanctuary Movement for Central American Refugees in the United States in the early 1980s. Our conversation will continue after a short break. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. I'm talking with former Catholic nun and activist Darlene Nagorski. She was convicted of crimes connected with her work in the sanctuary movement of the 1980s. She has since left the convent and moved to Chapel Hill. And in 1987, you were named Ms. Magazine Woman of the Year. What did you think of that?
I was kind of amazed. There was a whole bunch of awards that came at that time. So while we were convicted in Judge Carroll's court, there were a lot of people who thought what we did was very courageous. And I said, as I said to Judge Carroll, because once the trial was over and all that was waiting was the sentence, I wanted to say what was not said in the courtroom, so I made him sit through a 45-minute slideshow about conditions in Guatemala and El Salvador, and I would keep looking up and saying, Judge Carroll, what would you have done if you had seen what I saw? What would you have done if you heard what I heard? And I don't think that what I did or any one of my colleagues was anything different than anybody would have done if you had the same knowledge I did. I remember the first Guatemalan family I met in the Phoenix area. I was like, who else would understand why they had to flee and what life they came from than me? These people come into our culture, our situation. And so I just felt compelled to respond because I had that knowledge myself. I knew what it meant to be a refugee.
Let me, right along those lines, let me ask you this, because you had a deep moral conviction that what you were doing was right, and you broke the law. The Reagan administration broke the law. The Reagan administration broke the law supplying arms and funds to the Nicaraguan Contras. They also armed and subsidized the Iranian government and told the people, the American people, otherwise. They lied. They committed felonies. But they thought they were doing the right thing. Let's assume. What's the difference between you and them?
Well, I hope there is a difference, but I know for one thing I was not profiting from what I did. And I know that I learned in the journey by accompanying the poor, the people in need. And I think it's a different perspective of where you're coming from. If you're hanging around with arms dealers and you're protecting the millionaires and you're protecting this lifestyle rather than what can we do so that everybody in the world can have a better lifestyle? What can we do so that everybody in Durham or North Carolina can have a better lifestyle rather than a 2%? Then we're all going to be better off.
So if you're hanging around with lobbyists and gun dealers, you yes. probably never see those pictures that you showed in that courtroom.
No, you don't get to know the Juans, the Marias, the Jose's. They're real people, and you, in walking with them, you understand that journey. And I think that's part of what led me to take my own position with the Catholic Church that I did, because I supposedly was speaking for the voiceless. because sometimes the Central Americans couldn't tell their own story. They were afraid to. They often wore bandanas, if you see pictures of it from the 80s, covering their faces. Not fear here, but fear for their family left in their countries of El Salvador or Guatemala. And I think in walking that journey with them, I think they helped me to have the courage to see that I was a second-class citizen in my own church.
Well, what was the church, the official church, saying about your arrest and your conviction and your activities?
Well, that was also very interesting because there was a great deal of support from my congregation, from many religious congregations, mostly women and men. But the official church's position was a different issue. And I remember when it became very clear to me every day in Tucson during the trial, Monday when the week began, there was a prayer service at the cathedral. And a different, you know, it was the Unitarians or the Presbyterians, the Methodists. Every time it was a different group. We never once could get Bishop Moreno to walk the 10 steps from his office to come and be with us in a prayer service. And we went to see him about some donations and some money, because there were two Catholic priests that were on trial with me, one from Nogales, Arizona, and one from Nogales, Mexico. And he clearly said, you know, there was no money, he was sympathetic. Then months later, he was on the front page of the local Catholic paper, having breakfast at Republican fundraisers. And so it became clear to me where his perspective was in the institutional church. I think there were some archbishops that were supportive, but I think generally the institutional church didn't want to take a position on it.
And about this time, this is 1987 or so, you begin to come to terms with your own sexuality. And so tell us about that and then your deeper thoughts about your relationship with the Catholic Church.
Well, I think it was a gradual thing coming to my, it was a gradual experience coming to an understanding of, you know, the failings of the church and also my own sexuality. And I had actually started down a path of the journey of my sexuality before I was indicted, but decided I'll put that on the back burner and deal with that later, thinking it was going to be a few months. And it was like took over 2 years of my life between pre-trial and post-trial. And I think I know many women in the church, other people in the church who have the same awareness of the issues. But as long as they can live out their present commitments and serve, they will do so. But for me, and I think some of it was also speaking nationally on justice issues, that I could no longer live with the incongruence in myself.
Did you think it was possible to come out as a lesbian and remain a nun or to remain a Catholic?
At that time, it would not have been possible.
When did you make the decision then to leave the convent?
I took about a year after I moved to Massachusetts after the trial. I did a lot of public speaking that year and writing, and but I was also dealing with my own issues. And so it took about a year, and then I requested leave.
Was it difficult for you?
It was very difficult to leave a community of women concerned about justice issues. That part was difficult. And I don't think the institutional church was difficult because it had become more distant at that point. And there were so many clear divides in the institutional church.
Did you leave the church at the same time? Did you stop worshiping as a Catholic?
Pretty much, yes. Yes.
So you're in Boston at the time. What brought you to Chapel Hill?
My partner, Chris Blackburn, her mom needed more looking in on, and we were both going different directions to take care of elderly parents. So that and a little bit ready to get out of the hectic pace of Cambridge, Mass., although I loved it there. And so we came to Chapel Hill for that reason. And her mom passed away about 3 years ago. Mm. So we were fortunate to be with her in that journey the last 7 years.
Did you feel the need to find some kind of a faith community when you were here?
I did. I was part of a woman church movement in Boston area, and then we came here, and I was planning to go visit various churches because I did a lot of ecumenical work through the sanctuary movement and became very familiar with other congregations. And so there were a couple I was very interested in, and I saw articles about La Iglesia, which is part of the United Church of Chapel Hill, UCC Church, very large, very active, very involved organization. And I went there and I just felt comfortable with everything and so became a member.
You've had lots of time to think about this, and I wonder what your thoughts are as you consider your church, the Catholic Church, founded by a guy who was arrested. Convicted, and spent a lot of his time arguing against the institutions of religion. What is it about this church what are your feelings about that? A church that in many ways could be seen as embracing precisely the opponents of Jesus of Nazareth 2,000 years ago.
I don't know if I've thought about it in quite the same way, Frank, but I do think that it's a human institution as well. And I do think there's somewhat of a power perspective that is keeping the church stuck. I mean, there's been a woman church movement in the Catholic Church for probably at least 30 years, and not much institutionally has changed. So, I mean, that's just one issue. But I think the amount of time and money that has been spent on fighting acceptance of gay marriage or gay issues by the Catholic Church and the Mormon churches, I think just also speaks to how they're off course rather than being inclusive. Or as the United Church of Christ says, that God is still speaking. God is still speaking today, and the issues are different, but the message is the same.
So tell us what you're doing these days.
Well, after having organized all of my materials to donate to a library in California as a collection, since I retired from Piedmont Health Services, where I had the great opportunity to work in community health and was drawn to that because I felt I could make a difference in people's lives. I was working in human resources, but it wasn't just any job or widgets. It was concerned about people who don't have access to health care in many areas, quality health care. I've still been asked to do a lot of consulting, so I've been moving around, consulting nationally and helping different organizations get going. And we are preparing to move to Claremont, California to live at Pilgrim Place, which is a bit of an intentional community.
Which has a religious foundation as well, is it not?
Yes, it's for returning missionaries for the United Church of Christ, but it is much broader than that at this point. And
you recently had a chance to reconnect with a woman who you didn't know you knew or maybe didn't remember from your days in the sanctuary movement. Tell us about Maria.
Oh, the Maria Guardado story is really amazing because I hadn't had contact with refugees or even some of my colleagues from the movement. We had a 10th anniversary. And since then, there hasn't been much. And Maria started calling our house about 2 years ago this month and leaving message in Spanish, but never leaving a phone number, and that I had helped her and she wanted to thank me. Finally, we were able to connect, and she sent me many materials, and she sent me a documentary that was done on her life in 2000. I still wasn't sure I remembered her. Then in the course of organizing all these papers and materials, I discovered three folders of poetry and letters that she had written me. And she had spent about 2 weeks at my house when she first came here. And she has a very, very dramatic story. But the only reason I couldn't remember it was, unfortunately, there were so many who had similar stories, how she was a follower of Oscar Romero in El Salvador. She had been raped, tortured, left on the street for dead. Some family members rescued her, got her out, and was helped by human rights organizations in Mexico to get out of the country, and took sanctuary because she saw it as an opportunity to speak and tell the story about what was going on. And
she became an outspoken critic of, or at least educated herself about, the School of the Americas, for instance.
Yes, yes. She's done a lot of protesting around that.
How many people do you think came through that movement and are settled today in the United States, living lives that they might not have expected otherwise?
Thousands. Thousands, directly or indirectly. And I think those thousands of people influenced how many other thousands of people to help get the truth told about what was going on in Central America at the time, or it would have been hidden. The lies that were perpetuated by the Reagan administration would have just continued to convince the American people of what the story was.
You've gone through, as you said, you're collecting your memorabilia, your documents, you're giving them to the Claremont Library. What was it like for you to go through all those? Any revelations? Did you sort of re-understand what it was you lived through as a result?
Oh, yes. There were many things I forgot about, and I'm thankful to John Sharp from Cultural Properties, who helped keep me on track there to keep going through things, because sometimes it seemed a bit overwhelming. And then we'd discover some gem of a letter, such as we had one note that after the trial, and I don't remember how, one of the jurors passed a note to a reporter or an attorney who gave it to me. And in the note, this juror sat directly across from me for almost 9 months. And I remember one day I saw him about to faint. So you're not supposed to speak. So I passed a note to my attorney, who passed it to the bailiff, who passed it to the judge, and they called a recess. And so in this note, he thanks me for my care and concern and says that I'm a real nun because the prosecution kept trying to portray us as something other than what we were, and that Nixon, the government's main informant, was a real ass. That's what he said.
Good to come across that note again, isn't it? Darlene, what a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being here.
Okay. Thank you.
Darlene Nigorski is a former nun and one of the leaders of the sanctuary movement for Central American refugees in the United States in the 1980s. Today, with great sadness, we say goodbye to our hardworking, talented intern, Haley Sklut, who joined us between classes at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's helped us so much. We wish her well. Come back anytime. We never close, Haley. Thank you for your hard work. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.